Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
In June of 2014, a young man named Juliano Pinto made history at the World Cup. He wasn't the star of any soccer club, but a 29-year-old chosen to kick the first ball of the tournament. The hook? Pinto is paralyzed from the waist down, and he kicked the ball with the help of a robotic exoskeleton he controlled with his mind. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. The ball went just a short distance, but Pinto's kick represented the astonishing progress made in the arena of brain-machine interfaces. And my guest for the hour is one of the world's leading scientists in the field and the leader of the team that created the technology. Miguel Nicolelis is Distinguished Professor of Neuroscience, Neurobiology, Biomedical Engineering, and Psychology at Duke University. He's in town to speak about brain-machine interfaces tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health speaker series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. Miguel, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me again.
The last time you and I talked was about 5 years ago, and at the time, this historic kick was still in development. Were you confident then that it would happen? When you got the idea, did you know it would work?
Well, I knew in theory that it could work, but by the time we talked, you know, 5 years ago, when I put that in my book, it was just a concept that I thought at that time that I would be lucky if in my lifetime I would have the opportunity to make it happen. And as things go in life and in science, this amazing opportunity came up in 2008. And that's you know, how we got to the soccer field in the opening game of the World Cup.
And now you think it's possible that in your lifetime, a lot of people with these kinds of injuries might use this sort of equipment just to get through their daily lives.
Yes, one of the goals of the Walk Again project and of, you know, going through the craziness of that demonstration was to show to the world, to the whole world, because, you know, you had 1.2 billion people watching that moment, that this can be done, that if we really put our, you know, resources, intellectual resources, scientific technology resources, and we, you know, fund ideas like that, that aided, you know, therapies like that could come in the next decade or so and help, you know, tens of millions of people who suffer from paralysis and other neurological disorders.
At the start of making something like this work is the understanding that we humans can, say, hold something in our hands or control an external object, and somehow our bodies perceive it as if it's part of us.
Yeah, the beginning of all of this was the concept of brain plasticity, the idea that the brain is continuously adapting itself to a point in which, as you said, as we create technology and we become proficient in using technology, that technology becomes part of us. So the theory that we had in 12 years ago, 13 years ago, we proposed with many other people around the world, is that our cars, our bikes, soccer balls, you know, any tool that we use, our phones, our computers, they are simulated by the brain through this process of adaptation, physiological adaptation, as an extension of our bodies. Because the brain has an internal representation of what our body is and where it ends. But I like to say now that our bodies end at the end of the tool that we are using to perform a particular task.
So what does it take to map the brain and know where to sort of connect a sensor that will power a device so that we can have a thought and make something go?
Yeah, I like to say that we're like astronomers, you know, neuroscientists, because we have about 100 years of history of trying to map the brain. This was how neuroscience actually started. And, we had, sometimes my friends don't want me to say that, but that came from phrenology, you know, in
the
Europe.
The bumps on the head.
Yeah, bumps on the head and in the 19th century. But, of course, we have perfected that. It go beyond, much beyond that. That theory was not valid. But this mapping has evolved. There are many ways to look into the brain, many ways to image the brain. We particularly like to look at the electrical brainstorms that the brain creates and map the spread and origin of these brainstorms. And that's how we can decide where to put our sensors and to map the emergence of these voluntary motor programs that we all produce in our brains to move our body. So that's where the idea actually of brain-machine interfaces came. If we could read these brainstorms, or a fraction of them, you cannot read them all because they're gigantic, involves millions of elements. But if you could read a snapshot of it, could you decode it and get the message that is embedded in it and sent to a device that can perform the movement? That was the big question.
So for a device like that exoskeleton, can you only train someone to use it if they once had function, once knew how to move their legs and walk around, but lost that due to an accident or illness?
Yeah, we don't know the answer yet for that question, because brain-machine interfaces, as far as I can tell, have only been tested with patients that once had the ability to move and have lost that either due to a trauma or a disease of the central nervous system. But that's a very big question. Is the brain capable of generating a motor command for a movement that has never been performed by the body? And that's something that we want to address experimentally in animals, but we haven't been able to get to that point.
What do you imagine the answer is?
If I have to put my bet on it, yes, we could. We would be able to get something that can be transformed in a movement. And in a few trials, the brain would say, okay, that's what you want me to do. That's what I'm going to do. So you would be able to train the brain. And the reason I say that is because when we start working with our 8 patients for the World Cup, we measure the brain activity and we ask them, please imagine that you're moving your legs. They're all paraplegic for a decade at least, 6 to 13 years. There was nothing. Mm-hmm. We didn't see anything happening in the brain. The brain was quiet. It took us 3 months of training in a virtual reality environment for these patients to regain the concept of having legs and moving their legs before we even could put them in the exoskeleton. And at that point, we saw the blip in the brain every time they say, okay, I'm imagining that I'm playing soccer, let's say. And boom, we saw a change in the electrical signal generated by the brain. Then we knew that we have reintroduced the concept of walking. So I imagine that if I get a brain that has never walked, the same kind of thing could be done.
When you saw that little blip on the screen, was it like when you see those pictures of people at NASA watching, a space shuttle lift off?
I'm a son of the Apollo program, right? Mm-hmm. I told you when I came here 5 years ago, I became a scientist even though I was growing up in Brazil because of the moon landings. And that was the most stunning thing I have seen in my life. But I have to tell you, this got pretty close because we are there for 6 months in a bunker of a lab with people from all over the world. 25 countries were represented there. We have 4 official languages. And all of a sudden you look at that screen and you see something that nobody thought you would see. It's exactly what you said, the beep in the brain. And all of a sudden, when you put a patient in the exoskeleton, the patient walks for the first time in 10 years upright. And since we're sending feedback, tactile feedback back to the patient, to the arms of the patient, so they can feel the ground and everything, when that patient looks at you and say, I'm walking, and boy, that was a moon landing for us, for all of us.
Let's talk about that tactile feedback, because it's not so simple as just saying, okay, I want these artificial legs to move and propel me through space. You and I couldn't walk if we couldn't feel the ground beneath us.
Absolutely. And the patients, when we first put them, any patient, any paraplegic patient, in any device that you are upright again, but you don't feel the ground, what they say is that's very frightening because they're floating in air. So they don't have a sense of what is going on. And they don't know what is going to happen next moment, so they can fall. They can't because they are suspended. But that was exactly our reasoning. But we didn't want to create just a tiny little artificial sensation. We wanted to create a full embodiment of that exo. So we took us 6 months to find the correct parameters in the correct place in the body to deliver the feedback coming from these pressure sensors in the knees and in the surface of the foot of the exo. And we discovered that if you deliver that in the forearm skin, in a particular arrangement, a linear arrangement around the radial bone, you can induce a phantom limb sensation. So we fooled the brain. So when they walk, they're wearing a shirt, and as the feet touch the ground, they get this feedback in the arms, and all of a sudden they start reporting to us, I feel my foot. I feel my knee, and I'm walking by myself. They didn't feel the machine. And that's exactly what we wanted. But the first time, the first patient felt that, it was a shock.
So what do you use to create the sensation that the sole of a foot would feel on a hard surface?
Yeah, in fact, they got so good that we could simulate 3 different surfaces, and they will tell you whether it was grass, sand, or hot asphalt.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how good they got.
Well, let them walk on grass or sand. Don't put them on hot asphalt.
No. But the reason we did that is because one of the patients, the lady, she had a thermal phantom that I never seen in my career. So depending on the speed of the exo, her legs would warm up or cool down.
Wow.
So she detected movement by temperature, which is a very rare thing. But coming back to your question, what we discover is that if you have sensors in different locations of the foot surface, front and back, and then you create a wave, a pressure wave, and you deliver the pressure wave at a particular speed and a particular intensity on the skin of the forearm, and you put a mirror so the patient sees the walking by the time he's getting that, either in a virtual reality environment or in a real life setting, the brain gets full. The brain merges the visual image of walking with the tactile feedback and basically creates the illusion that, okay, my legs are moving and I'm touching the ground. So the patients don't feel that they're being touched in the arm. This is the most stunning thing.
So I'm really curious about the working relationship that your folks have with the people building these robotic devices and the ways that you've learned to communicate with one another, because how sophisticated must the exoskeleton be to be able to read signals from the brain rather than sort of plug in like this microphone is plugged in?
Well, I feel like I did a sabbatical in robotics. I'm a neuroscientist. I never built a robot in my life, but I have a wonderful friend, Gordon Schenk from the Technical University of Munich, who the day I call him and said, look, would you like to be on the opening ceremony of the World Cup? He said, of course. You know, and I said, well, there's only a detail. We need to build a 15 degree of freedom exoskeleton controlled by the brain that can provide tactile feedback to the patients to kick the ball. He stopped and he said, isn't there an easier way to get to that game? But Gordon basically worked with a team. We had distributed team in Europe, in Brazil, and the United States, basically. And if you go to our lab in São Paulo, what is absolutely unique is that you have the roboticist next to the neuroscientist, next to the neuro rehab people, physicians, nurses, physical therapists, or occupational therapists, everybody. And the development was done as a multidisciplinary effort. So we had to learn the language of the roboticist, who had no idea of how to build a robot with a human inside, because they all build robots that are walking by themselves or doing stuff, is very different. When they put the software to work and we put the first patient in there in a testing device, there's, you know, all protect and everything, the patient wanted to control the robot immediately. And the controller of the robot could not take the speed of the changes in mental commands that the patient was taking. So I had to go to the engineering team and said, you don't understand. This is not a computer anymore controlling the robot. That is a higher order controller.
Right.
That's the brain of the patient. So we had to actually change the entire control strategy to create something that we call a share control, where the human brain inside the thing has the hierarchical control of everything. It decides what to do, how to move, where to go. And the machine adapts to the human brain, not the other way around. That's how it worked.
We're speaking this hour with Miguel Nicolelis. He is Distinguished Professor of Neuroscience, Neurobiology, Biomedical Engineering, and Psychology at Duke University, in town to speak about brain-machine interfaces tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health speaker series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with neuroscientist Miguel Nicolelis of Duke University. He's in town to speak about brain-machine interfaces tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health speaker series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Miguel, are there advantages to creating a walking exoskeleton as opposed to, say, just a really terrific wheelchair that one controls, but is still not, you know, doesn't resemble the way we get around normally?
Yeah, that was the primary question we had 3 years ago when we started the consortium, the Walk Again Consortium, because we didn't know. You know, that was an open question. And one of the things we wanted to do is to actually provide an answer for that question over the years, over the 3 years that we had, you know, until now. And the answer is yes, it's a major difference. We evolved to walk. We evolved to be upright. Our brain actually evolved to control a body that walks. So when we put these guys up, these patients up after a decade in a wheelchair, and they were able to, you know, we may think that it's little, but 1 hour a day upright, walking or doing exercises upright, we saw a tremendous physiological revolution in their bodies. Because you think about, okay, the main thing is to recover motor and tactile sensations, which they did, by the way. But
including in the limbs they couldn't move anymore.
Below the level of the lesion. This is something that we're reporting now. We send these papers for publication. Is never heard. You know, at this level, is almost 80% of the patients recover some kind of motor control of their legs and tactile nociceptive sensation, pain sensation below the lesion. But we also saw an improvement in cardiovascular function, which people knew, but two of our patients were hypertense and they took medication for blood pressure, high blood pressure. They don't take it anymore. The blood pressure is normalized. They recover peristaltic movements. So they recover the ability to control the timing of going to the bathroom or not, which is a major thing. Several patients recover bladder control. So being upright, you know, is a fundamental behavior for our body's physiology and in many systems, not only the musculoskeletal system like we thought. So, in fact, some of these patients that had problems with osteoporosis, for instance, severe osteoporosis, we didn't improve, but we stopped the process of degradation of the bones, which is very important. They gain muscle mass. They had less problems with their joints. So the answer, and that's one of the papers we just submitted, is being upright is essential. And that could be something that will change the way we manage even patients that have been diagnosed with a complete spinal cord injury.
Why is the spinal cord so fragile and so resistant to recovery?
Well, the spinal cord is a tube of nerves, you know, millions of nerves running up and down. It's protected by these bones. They are very, you know, robust. But unfortunately, you know, the modern society exposes us to traumas that are very powerful, a car crash, a shot, a knife wound. And there are neurological disorders that are able to destroy either the cord or the connections between the cord and the muscles, the peripheral nerves. The good news is, people know that the spinal cord is also plastic. The problem is how to get a handle of this plasticity, how to get a handle of the adaptability or the capacity to adapt that the spinal cord has, like the brain. And we, for a long time, thought that this was going to be done just with the motor signals, either by stimulating the cord or by getting signals from the brain to drive some sort of stimulation or by putting new cells in the lesion. We are, I think, discovering with this project that the feedback is the way the brain gets the statistics from the world that is needed to drive this plasticity. So we cannot prove yet because it's very difficult to image the spinal cord of these patients. They have metal rods to stabilize the vertebra because of the fractures they had, so you cannot put them in a magnet. But our suspicion is that what we are witnessing, particularly the neurological recovery that we are seeing below the level of the lesion, is a product of both brain and spinal cord plasticity. It's a combination of both because it's a very widespread phenomenon that cannot be explained only by cortical, you know, the higher order motor center plasticity. Something is happening in the spinal cord.
So I know that you're not doing consumer medicine, but it is your hope that this technology will be available to more and more people. I would imagine anybody listening thinks, I want a piece of that. How long before these therapies will be available widely?
Yeah, that's the main question that we got during the project and after the project. We had already a second prototype of the exoskeleton because, of course, the first prototype, you over-engineer everything because you're concerned about safety, you're concerned about... I mean, people ask me, well, why the kick was so mild? I said, well, the exo could kick the ball across the half field. It could go all the way to the goal. However, you cannot exert that kind of force on the leg of a patient that has been in a wheelchair for 10 years.
Right.
You would take a huge risk of a pathological fracture, damaging joints, getting a bone out of the joint.
Because so, those bones and joints have weakened.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the ligaments, you should see. When I first saw, I mean, I'm a physician by training, but I was away from medicine for 27 years. When I first saw the examination of these patients and I saw how much muscle mass they had lost and ligament strength, you could see that, you know, the femur could get out of the hip very easily. So we had to actually measure what kind of force they can produce when their leg is moving that is not that is safe. And we have to basically reduce the power of that exo to almost nothing just to be comfortable and be safe to the point that not induce any lesion. So all these details roboticists have never had to deal with before. Hmm. And that's the reason you need a team, a multidisciplinary team working together. So it's a long way to say that we are already planning a third prototype that will be a more compact and something that we envision could be, you know, the framework for something that people could have, could take home, could use not only in a hospital, because that's what we have. We have this in a lab setting now. And there are many challenges, but I have to say, at this moment, the biggest challenges are not neuroscience or rehab science anymore. They are robotics. They are in the robotics. Because if you want to produce a robot that is autonomous, that can give balance, can help the patient in any terrain, that's not trivial, and virtually nobody can do it right now. So you need to come with new solutions for that. And that's the limiting factor for getting exos controlled by brains and provide feedback that people could use. So I'm hoping that in the next decade, given the enthusiasm that these things are generating now, we'll be able to do that.
Are there certain parts of the world that are turning out the best robotic scientists? I know that your labs have people from everywhere.
Yeah.
Is there a certain region that you look to when you want someone who's going to be a robotics expert?
That's a good question. I mean, there are phenomenal roboticists everywhere. But you know that per capita, Japan is the largest investor in robots in the world. Yet, when the nuclear plant had the accident there, they didn't have a robot capable of getting in there and turning the thing off. Fukushima exposed the fact that robotics in Japan is phenomenal, but some of those robots really are not doing some things that are very useful. Particularly, you couldn't save the lives of people. You know, human beings had to walk in there. That showed, and the Japanese government got very nervous about it and reacted to it. So you have phenomenal robotics here in the U.S., of course, and in Germany, Switzerland, and France, that corner, you know, they have lots of great groups. So we had a hybrid team. We had a team from Europe and the U.S. Yet, one thing that, for me, you know, I have been here working as a scientist for 27 years now, it would be difficult in this climate today to pull off a walk-again project in the United States.
Why?
Because you simply couldn't get funded, you couldn't get the, you know, through the you know, the bureaucracy of putting a vision like that in place. And that was, for me, was a big surprise. Because when I took the idea to Brazil, which is not known at all for investing in big projects like that, despite the fact that in the last decade or so, investments in science have gone sixfold, the idea was taken. And when we said, look, we don't even want to do just with Brazilian scientists. We want 100-some people from all over the world who are willing to come and open their patents and do everything. It was really well received. I don't think I could manage to get that done here. You know, and that's something that, you know, worries me. Because, you know, this is the country where I got these ideas to do these things.
You've said that you were inspired watching Brazil's transition to democracy.
Oh, tremendously. Yeah. I grew up in a dictatorship. I grew up, and my father was a judge. And he, at the end of his career, he got to the state Supreme Court in São Paulo. And he saw the pressures and were tremendous. He was threatened many times. And I was growing up in that. And when the country finally came back to, you know, to the democratic system, It was something. And then I left. I left a year later. So it took me 30 years to vote for president down there.
Hmm. Talk about this. Do you suspect that there is an ideal window after a patient has suffered a spinal cord injury to begin using this technology that might, if not cure people, certainly mitigate some of the long-term damage?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. In fact, we have just recruited a new group of 9 patients that have suffered a spinal cord injury just 12 to 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. Because our patients, as I said, were a minimum 6 years, maximum 13 years after the lesion. So this is very chronic. They have tried everything and nothing really gave them any improvement. So we knew that this was a very clear group to test the idea first. But now that we have seen this partial neurological recovery, we were intrigued. So the next logical step was to come to and recruit a population that just suffered this lesion. So you have about a year of a period in which my colleagues in neuro rehab, spinal cord rehab, tell me you need to basically stabilize the patient and make sure that there is no cardiovascular risk, no any other safety issue. After that, the patient becomes to be considered a chronic patient, particularly the ones that are classified as clinically as complete spinal cord injuries. So we thought that that was the safest bet, is to wait 12 months and recruit a pool of patients from 12 to 18 months. Our prediction is, if what we saw is what we think it is, that we should see more of a recovery, more of a functional recovery. And as you said, if you can mitigate, even if you cannot restore, you know, what it was before, but if you can mitigate most of these deficits, you're already helping these patients, you know, a lot.
Is it important, too, to consider the fact that they may still be emotionally traumatized by what's happened if it's just been a year or a year and a half since their injury?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, we think that the phantoms they're going to experience, when we induce the lower limb phantoms, they will be related to the accident. So we have a team of psychologists following every patient. And over the 2 years that we have followed the first group, we actually have a total description of the accidents and what they felt at that moment. And some of these patients had what we call a recall experience while they're walking on the exoskeleton. In one of the days they were walking there, they actually sense something that they sense just before the car accident, or the one of the patients was run over by a bus and survived. So she was waiting on a corner, you know, for a car. And she recalls what she was feeling. And when she was walking one day, she starts describing to us on camera. You know, that was a very powerful experience. That's the same lady that has this thermal phantom.
Yeah.
And I think is related to the last memory. The thermal phantom is related to the last memory she had of the, you know, when she was run over.
It sounds almost supernatural. That's remarkable.
Yeah, but it's a description. It's very vivid.
Yeah.
We have all of this in tape, and we have analyzed these videos with a lot of experts on phantom limb sensation and psychologists, and they all say, look, this is a very credible description. And she was in a virtual reality environment, so there was no reason, you know, for not describing what she is feeling.
Do you imagine that there are applications for this technology that might be used by people whose bodies are healthy but need to do things that surpass the capability of the human body?
Yes. Well, first of all, it's important to say that we also think that this technology could be used by stroke patients or by other patients, not only spinal cord injury patients. One of my friends in Switzerland, who is an expert on exoskeletons and is working on a compact design with us, Hannes Bloor, he is creating exoskeletons for the elderly to avoid falls, the potential for fractures on hip and femur, which is a big deal. So he thinks that in the future people will have exos just to protect them from these falls that we have when we are aging. Of course, there are a lot of people thinking that brain control devices may augment our normal functions, and there are some good applications for it, and there are some that I don't think are so good. But certainly we have seen that in animals, healthy animals, that we can use a brain machine interface to, for instance, acquire a new sense or acquire a new motor skill that the animal is not used to do, Or even recently we published a paper in which three monkeys collaborated mentally on a brain-machine interface we call a BrainNet. And they basically divided the task of moving a virtual arm. So each monkey was responsible for a third of the task. And for the task to be completed, they really need to collaborate fully. And they did. They learned to do it.
All right, let's talk about that. You sort of wired together the brains of these monkeys so that they, one would actually experience the sensation, but the others would have a sense of it somehow?
No, it's a little different. But suppose you had three monkeys, mm-hmm. and you have a virtual arm that needs to be moved in 3D, X, Y, and Z. And the hand has to go to a target that is moving. And only if the hand gets to the target, the monkeys get a drop of fruit juice, which they love. Mm-hmm. The monkeys didn't even know of the presence of the other companions. You know, they are in three different rooms. We are recording about 300 neurons per monkey. So we computationally merge these 900 neurons into a super brain. And monkey one was in charge of controlling just the X and Y axis of the movement. Monkey two was controlling the Y and Z. And monkey three was controlling the X and Z. So no single monkey could move the arm. You need at least two monkeys to synchronize their brain activity so the three dimensions could be controlled. But, you know, to make it really smooth, you need a third guy to smooth it out, because if one monkey is not doing very well, the third compensates for that, you know, lazy monkey in the middle. And we didn't inform them. We didn't give them anything but the view of the arm that they control, let's say the X and Y for the first monkey, and the reward if they get it right. And in a few minutes, they, boom, synchronize their brains, and by all purposes and means, is working like a single brain. And it worked, and you saw the brain synchronizing. So for us, that is a very good experimental paradigm to see how our brains actually synchronize the multiple areas to get things done.
We're speaking this hour with Miguel Nicolelis. He is Distinguished Professor of Neuroscience, Neurobiology, Biomedical Engineering, and Psychology at Duke, in town to speak about brain-machine interfaces tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health speaker series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Miguel Nicolelis. He is Distinguished Professor of Neuroscience, Neurobiology, Biomedical Engineering, and Psychology at Duke. He'll speak tonight as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health speaker series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. The subject of that talk is brain-machine interfaces. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org, which is where we hear from Taylor in Oak Cliff, who writes, "How much do you have to concentrate on the movement for the suit to move? Do you need to focus on each movement, as in, I'm lifting my left foot, I'm placing it down, I'm lifting my right foot, or does the suit learn your intentions so that you just think, I'm going to walk three steps?"
Yeah, it's all a progression process. You know, in the beginning, we ask the patients to just imagine, I want to start moving, and I want to stop moving, or I want to move faster or slower. And the computer system that we had merged with the robotics would basically take care of the low-level mechanics that needs to be done to get that going. So when the patient modulate the brain activity to start the movement, you know, the axle would start moving.
Hmm.
After a few months of training, we realized that the patients could do much more. So we actually start having them use each part of the brain, the left and the right, independently to control each leg. So now our patients literally control each leg the way we do normally, you know, but we're not very conscious of it. So we got the patients to initiate and terminate them, or to cycle each leg independently. And recently, the last couple months, we realized that we can even go a little more. And we are training now these patients to for a strategy to make turns.
Wow.
You know, but it's a process. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to give the patient time to adapt. And after a few weeks, you can see that they are feeling much more natural inside the device, and they start relying on the robotics much more.
So I'm sure I'm oversimplifying this, but my understanding is that part of the mobility problems that Parkinson's patients have, aside from the tremors that they might have and muscle weakening, is that they have to think deliberately about movements that are automatic for you and me. Could this technology work for people with that condition?
Yeah, if you have a patient that cannot move anymore, the Exo could be used. But we actually discover, is interesting that you mentioned Parkinson's, because in our lab we discover a new brain-machine interface that could be used for Parkinsonian patients. It involves actually stimulating the surface of the spinal cord. Like with a heart pacemaker, we discovered that if you put a brain pacemaker on the surface of the spinal cord between the cervical and the thoracic vertebra, you don't need to open the spinal cord. You just deposit that on the surface, and you send high-frequency pulses to the brain of, we did that in rats, monkeys, and now there are about 50 patients around the world who have used this technology. In a Parkinsonian patient that is frozen, that cannot move, you know, it basically, if you send this high-frequency electrical pulse, it dissolves that difficulty, and the patient can walk and improves the walking of it. So we started with the exoskeleton idea, but when we saw what we can do, when we saw Parkinsonian patients, we adapted what we had learned, and it seems to be a potential therapy now. We are going to see there were large clinical trials that are being planned at this point, but it was just a spin-off of what we had done for paralysis that allowed us to think about treating Parkinson's in a very different way.
How do you train physical therapists to help patients learn to use these technologies?
Well, first we start with the classical training. I mean, we had a team of, you know, the best physical therapists in the whole of Brazil, because they came from a spinal cord injury hospital that has about 65,000 patients in a database. They were very used to take care of the bones, muscles, and the classical physical therapy. But then they got in an environment where they had to handle a patient inside of a robotic suit, which is very different, because you have to look for points in which the suit is pressing to the skin. These patients have very thin skin, and they can be damaged very easily. You have to be very careful, because you don't want infections, and, you know, that can be very serious. So this team learned, you know, a complete new trait, you know, just by how a human interact with a device of that complexity. But more than that, lately, because of that experiment I mentioned, the brain at with the monkeys, we realized that we can expand the physical therapy approach and to have some of these members of the team helping the patient learn how to use the brain-machine interface by lending their brain activity in the beginning of the training. So we are about to finish an implementation of the BrainNet for physical therapists, in which the physical therapist is going to play the game, the virtual reality game that you use to train the patients, together with the patient. And that game involves controlling a body avatar, an avatar on a screen, to stand up, walk, and kick a soccer ball. Well, in the beginning, the patient has a lot of difficulty because he has forgotten how to control legs. We are going to basically borrow the physical therapist's brain activity. You know, about 90% of that will come from his or her brain, and 10% from the patient, and merge it, like we did for the monkeys, to control the avatar. So that means that the patient is going to get positive reinforcement very early on.
So it's not just so frustrating that they can't do it.
Exactly.
Can't do it.
That's the problem. You have to really, in the beginning, the first 10 days or 2 weeks, we have to start with the patient and encourage him to continue, because he's failing most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with the help of the physical therapist, which, by the way, doesn't even need to be next to the patient. It can be anywhere in the planet. He's going to play the game and start winning since the beginning. And we hope that that will make plasticity develop faster and the learning go faster. So the patient can have a benefit of collaborating with his physical therapist, her physical therapist.
So let's talk a little bit more about this idea of putting brains together. You've done this in the lab with animals. And,
yeah,
of course, there are sort of different ethical concerns when you're dealing with animals than with human beings.
Oh, absolutely.
Lots of people, though, are aware of certain applications that take computer power from all over the world and they put it together to solve complex problems. Could something like that be done with the computing power in our craniums?
Yeah, well, the problem then now, besides the ethical issue, is the technology issue. Because when you're doing that with monkeys, you can record the brain activity inside the brain. And that has much more resolution, much more information. So you can do more complex tasks. To use the same approach in humans, to do a brain net in humans right now, in fact, a couple groups have done it here at University of Washington and in Europe. And we use non-invasive technology. So recordings of electrical signals from the scalp, which is called electroencephalography. And when you are recording from outside, you lose a lot of resolution. You mm-hmm. lose a lot of information. And because of that, the demonstrations of a brain-to-brain collaboration, brain-to-brain interface in humans that have appeared in the last 2 years, they're just proofs of concept, but they are just basically binary decisions. They don't involve like a more, you know, analog, let's say, a collaboration where you would be solving a puzzle by combining multiple minds together. So that's the barrier that we have to overcome for that to happen one day. In animals, we are doing very complex tasks now because we can get inside the brain. But that would not be acceptable from an ethical point of view in a normal, healthy human being. You wouldn't put a probe inside of the head of anybody just to play a game or to work in a you know, collective of brains. I wouldn't justify it at all. So we need to wait for non-invasive technology that would gather information at the same resolution that we get when we were able to get inside the brain.
You have said, and this is really interesting, that our brains might naturally synchronize without us really fully being aware of it. Maybe this Sunday when everybody was watching the game on TV?
Oh, absolutely. I have divine... in my new book, I'm writing about a new concept that I call the organic computer. Mm-hmm. And the organic computer is basically that. You see that in nature all the time. Ants working together, birds flying together, fish swimming together in schools of fish, so flocks of birds. And in our case, you see this since the you know remote times where we learn to speak or learn to draw in caves, you know, create a scenery in cave that probably helped young adults to learn how to hunt or was a record of what had happened that could be communicated to you know, groups of humans. But as we developed and our technologies of communication develop, you know, from telegraph to radio, TV, and now to the internet, I think we got this to a scale that nobody has ever conceived. So we can synchronize humans now on a scale of millions by watching TV or being in a stadium, or you're in a stadium like in a Super Bowl game, and you get a computation. You get information generated, on even knowledge generated by this synchronization that occurs only because this huge number of brains are interacting. And sometimes you're in the middle of a defense, right, on a game. In Brazil, it's very common. I feel this sensation all the time in a soccer game. You almost lose the sensation that you are by yourself. You are part of this group. And what is coming out of the group, noise, singing, crying, whatever, is a computation. It's a computation that is the process of multiple brains synchronized. So I think this happens all the time in nature.
Do you, you know, science fiction writers will think about people communicating directly brain to brain, either through some technology or through something else that facilitates this. Will there ever be any reason for that to, you know, not use any obvious external technology to communicate?
Well, you know, one day I was writing this paper, a review of our paper that we published in 2013, and someone sent me a note, an email saying, you know, you should read, although I have read almost everything he wrote, but I didn't this one. Arthur Clarke's 3001 mm-hmm. is the last book of the, you know, 2001 trilogy. Well, I got the book, first chapter, the astronaut that had been lost during 2001, at the end of the movie, he's lost in space. Everybody thinks he died, but he didn't. He survives. He wakes up in 3001, 1,000 years later, and when he wakes up, there are a group of physicians around him who do not talk, and they have these funny caps in their heads. So Arthur Clarke was having people communicate brain to brain, and it's called the brain cap. And he was basically saying, I cannot hear what these guys are saying because they are not talking. Well, he had to have a brain cap so he could actually get whatever. And they used their brain cap in that book to upload to his brain 1,000 years of history that he had missed. So he was seeing that, Arthur Clarke, and at the end of the 70s. late 70s. And so if you have a non-invasive technology, and you could think about collaboration, of course, you could. And I think what we are doing in the lab before this technology comes is to describe the principles, the physiological principles that would be involved in a synchronization of multiple brains to do something. So it's basic science, a little ahead of science fiction, if I may say, or ahead of technology development.
Do you continue to read a lot of science fiction now? Is it something you did mostly when you were young and sort of considering this career?
No, I used to read a lot. My mom is a writer, so we at home we had everything you can imagine. And the funny part is a few years ago I went to a science fiction writing congress or meeting, and I was talking to science fiction writers. And my joke to them was saying, you know what, you guys need to speed it up because we're getting close. Real science is getting pretty close to what you guys said. So I'm waiting for new ideas, you know, and it was just a provocation. But I like to read it still. I still like to see what they're thinking about.
Do you walk in there like a rock star? I mean, at a conference like that, do they all know exactly who you are?
Well, I don't. No scientist is a rocket star. But it was funny because I think they knew. And when I show the first slides, some of the slides I'm going to show tonight, which for me are very historical because it's the first demonstration of a monkey, I like to say, liberating its own brain to exert an action on the world without the body. So the brain is free, you know. And when I show that, I noticed that people look and said, whoa, this is better than the science fiction because it's real, you know, it has happened. And that's what I think science is. And we should be showing this to our kids and, you know, to everybody in society. That some of these things that we think that only happen in movies actually can happen in real life, in labs around the country, around the world. And they can have an effect on our species that is tremendous, if you think about it.
Where's the money coming from for this research? Is it private funds, government funds?
Well, the basic science is mainly all over the world, including the United States, coming from public funds. Mm-hmm. But the problem is you need vision. You know, to do this kind of thing is the thing. You probably remember in my first book in the acknowledgments, I acknowledged the U.S. taxpayer, and it's rare that this happens in acknowledgments. But I felt that it was fundamental.
Yes, it
was fundamental because I came from Brazil as a medical student, PhD student, and I came here because I believed that here you could do these big things. Mm-hmm. And I found a wonderful guy who actually came from Texas. He was here at UT Southwest for a while, John Chapin, which is my hero. And he gave me the freedom to work and get these things done. And he was there with me all the time. And in the 80s, early 90s, I felt that anything could be done science-wise. And I think that's what we need to do again. We need to go for big things.
Miguel Nicoleles is Distinguished Professor of Neuroscience, Neurobiology, Biomedical Engineering, and Psychology at Duke University. He'll speak tonight about brain-machine interfaces as part of the UTD Center for Brain Health speaker series, The Brain and Owner's Guide. Miguel, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation. It was a pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy with help on the phones today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.